In Anaheim, the gathered members of the American Library Association hear why libraries may be more important than ever, even in the throes of the digital publishing revolution. But what the librarians think, and what they think the publishers think, is that the two sides are headed for a showdown. In reviews, a debut novel is hailed as a harrowing satire of the Iraq War and an instant classic. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, CCC's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a look at the news that everyone will be talking about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show, back from Anaheim himself, is Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Andrew, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, indeed, you were away. We chatted with you just at the start of things at the ALA conference. And what were your impressions of the show?
Well, it's good to be back. And I must say, it was also nice to be away. As I understand, the East Coast was sweltering in a heat wave while I was in beautiful, sunny, cool Anaheim. Overall, it was an upbeat show this year for ALA. I have to say, there was a lot of positive energy and a lot of excitement. By the numbers, it was a more modest success. Attendance clocked in at just over 20,000, and was almost exactly flat with last year's total in New Orleans. But, you know, given the fiscal straits that many libraries find themselves in, that's not a terrible showing. The numbers always dip when the show's on the West Coast anyway, when you get away from the more populous cities of the East or the Midwest. In 2009, ALA set a record with 29,000 people attending the show in Chicago, and 26,000 attended in 2010 when it was in Washington, D.C. You have to wonder if ALA is ever going to see 29,000 attendees again, but, you know, we'll see. Next year, the show returns to Chicago. And a bit of good news, too, the exhibitors actually ticked up a little bit in 2012. And anecdotally speaking, the show floor was really quite alive with a host of new players, technology companies, indie publishers, etc. So, you know, for all the disruption and creative destruction we're constantly talking about, there really was this, you know, palpable wave of innovation that seems to be coming into the library market. So that gives me hope that once again we can get higher numbers around the 29,000 mark, hopefully, depending on how the economy and the political environment turns.
Well, as you say, Andrew, the pressure on the library community is pretty intense, and it's coming not only from all the changes in technology, but there certainly is a bright spot in the story, at least this one, which is this new award that came out at the conference itself.
Yeah, that was a real highlight of this year's meeting, is that, you know, in 2012, a committee of librarians did what the Pulitzer Prize people could not do. They actually selected a winning work of fiction. They gave the first ever Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction to Irish novelist Anne Enright for her book, The Forgotten Waltz, which is published by the fine people at W.W. Norton. Robert K. Massey took home the nonfiction honors for his Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman, published by Random House. The awards were emceed by Seattle librarian and PW columnist and my friend, don't stutter on that one, Nancy Pearl. And there was a really well-attended standing room only reception with a lot of energy. People were really happy to be celebrating reading, and I think not to be talking about ebooks. And I think this new book award for adult fiction and nonfiction is really going to be a source of pride for the library community and also a driver of sales for authors and publishers. You know, as you know, the Caldecott and Newbery Awards in youth media are already the most prestigious for children's literature, and arguably they're the most influential awards of any in the world in terms of generating sales. So a couple of thoughts about the award. You know, as its name suggests, the award is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. It's co-sponsored by ALA. And the finalists and winners are picked by a jury of librarians. And that's a good thing, I think, because librarians are not only voracious readers themselves, but they interact with customers, their patrons, who are voracious readers too. Russell Banks was at the awards ceremony, and he said that he was honored by his nomination because the award was authenticated by librarians. And I think ALA Executive Director Keith Fields really nailed it in his remarks before the awards were announced. you know, beyond the financial support, he said, the most important thing the Carnegie Corporation has given to this award is its name. And indeed, Carnegie is a name that's in class with Pulitzer, and you can easily see this award growing in stature year after year. And I'll go back to Russell Banks for a moment, because he said some great things in his remark. Even though he didn't win, he really praised libraries and said that they were the connective tissue, what, you know, connects writers to the world, more so than bookstores, even more so than academia, more so than critics and reviews. And no offense, Rose, he still loves you, and even more so than publishers. That's a really interesting point that he makes about the connective tissue. And I have to say those remarks were somewhat belied by some of the underlying tension that continues to simmer when it comes to ebooks.
Well, libraries more important than publishers. I bet they'd get a debate going on that. And, and indeed, that tension you talk about comes on the heels of an announcement from Penguin about a new pilot program for ebook lending in libraries. And as well, this report from Pew about the massive opportunity that ebooks may present in the library community. Tell us more.
Yeah, you know, the word that comes to mind is a word that publishers often mention when it comes to libraries, and that's friction. First regarding Penguin, the official ALA line at the show was that, hey, we're all really happy to have Penguin back at the table. But the reality that I found was that not all librarians were terribly happy with this. And on Sunday, there were this last Sunday at ALA, there were two panels of note. One was an excellent discussion with Lee Rainey from the Pew Foundation himself. And, you know, Rainey really drove home the point that we are in the midst of a true digital revolution, and that's coming to reading too. And that libraries really have a place in that future, and that they're going to be vital, and that we really need to sort of open our eyes to the opportunities here. Rainey said that his Pew data showed that borrowing really doesn't diminish buying. In fact, it encourages buying, most likely, and that's supported by another report that Library Journal published earlier this year, its patron profiles, that found the same thing. But it was later in a Sunday afternoon session at ALA, there was the ALA Working Group on Digital Content. Things got really interesting at that meeting. There were some great presentations from the Digital Public Library of America, and our contributing editor Peter Brantley spoke as well, and Eric Hellman from Unglued. But at one point, a librarian from Sweden got up to talk in the question and answer period and related how in her country, the librarians have recently left the table in talks with publishers over access to ebooks. And the sense that I got from the panelists and from librarians that I spoke to was that a moment like that could be useful for ALA. Now, my sense is that, you know, ALA would prefer to keep having discussions with authors or with publishers, and that's a good thing. But it can't keep having discussions and labeling programs like Penguins as progress without potentially losing the support of some of their membership. You know, mark my words, I think this is going to be a challenge for ALA in the coming months. You know, for all the kind words about keeping dialogue open and Penguin returning to the table, not one librarian I spoke to spoke positively about Penguin's pilot or the pilot's potential to really deliver any data that's going to lead to a more positive long-term outcome. This program is a year long, you'll recall. It deals with one major library system, and front list titles are not available for 6 months of that year. So we're not really sure exactly what we're testing here, and what do we really expect Penguin's going to do at the end of the year? I think those are all fair questions for librarians to be asking. Now, this is an NYPL venture. But, you know, at some point, one librarian told me, ALA is going to find they may have more gain in terms of keeping their members engaged by getting up and leaving the table, as the Swedish librarians did, and reiterating their foundational beliefs, rather than by allowing the center of the ebook discussions to continue to shift to terms, publishers' terms specifically, that the community finds unacceptable, like the windowing of titles that Penguin has put into its pilot program. Now, obviously, I think dialogue is good. Dialogue is great, actually. And no one is saying that publishers and librarians shouldn't be talking through the ebook issue. But at an ALA where six award nominees all extolled the vital place of libraries in the world of literature, and where research from Pew showed the potential benefits of libraries lending ebooks, you know, rank and file librarians, I think, are justified in wondering at one point the ebook discussions undertaken by ALA leaders might have to move in another direction.
Well, we'll expect you to follow that story. We'll look forward to more about the ALA conference in Monday's issue. And what else have you got coming?
Well, it's our Global 54 coverage. It's our annual rankings of the world's biggest publishers. You know, spoiler alert, you may have already heard, Pearson, owners of Penguin, remain atop the list. Our Rachel Deal takes a look at literary agents and their forays into ebook publishing, which is, you know, a fascinating, somewhat complex issue. And since we're off next week for the 4th of July, I'd like to take this opportunity to wish you and our listeners a very happy 4th of July holiday. Hopefully you can all find a nice beach on which you can curl up with a good book. Perhaps N.N. writes The Forgotten Waltz, best fiction of 2012, librarians say, or should I suggest something by the late, great Nora Ephron.
That's a great idea. And what I thought as I read through the list of accomplishments of Nora Ephron, it struck me that the first thing she was a journalist, and I felt proud of that. That's a really great way to end the note. You have a great fourth as well, and don't play with firecrackers.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. Now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose. And what kind of books have you got this week?
Hi, Chris. It's good to be here. We have a debut that you mentioned earlier. This is Fobbit by David Abrams, his first novel. It's a harrowing satire of the Iraq War and an instant classic, our reviewer says. Abrams served, much like his protagonist, as a public relations officer for the war effort, putting an Iraqi face on the conflict. And we say that this debut really nails the comedy and the pathos, the boredom and the dread, crafting the Iraq War's answer to Catch 22. So that's high praise. We've got a profile this week of Martin Amis. He talks about the British tabloid inspiration behind his new novel, Lionel Asbo's State of England, which starts off with a bang with the 15-year-old Des admitting in a letter to the Agony Angel of the Morning Lark newspaper that he's been having an affair with his grandmother. We also have a Q&A with M.L. Stedman about her debut novel, The Light Between Oceans. She talks about writing instinctively, following the picture or phrase or voice that enters her head, and the joy of not knowing where a story is going. This issue also features a signature review. I'm sure you know PW reviews are usually anonymous, but every once in a while we have a big name reviewed by another big name. In this case, it's Benjamin Percy reviewing Victor Laval's new literary horror novel, The Devil in Silver. And Percy, who wrote Refresh, Refresh and The Wilding, says of this book, which takes place in a cash-strapped mental hospital in Queens, to think of it as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest meets Dante's Inferno. He has a few minor quibbles, but says the novel is expertly written. It will leave you wondering about its many memorable characters and lingering over questions about fear, horror, madness, suffering, friendship, and love.
And in mysteries this week, Rose, a genius and a Machiavellian. In fact, the first Machiavellian get together.
Michael Ennis brilliantly recreates the politics of early 16th century Italy in The Malice of Fortune. It's an absorbing and intelligent thriller, and it teams up Machiavelli with Leonardo da Vinci. It could have come across as a contrived partnership, but it's anything but. The pair look into a series of brutal murders, and cloven footprints near the bodies suggest the devil himself may be responsible. A momentary lapse of judgment leads to dire consequences in Michael Cardos's outstanding first novel, The Three-Day Affair, in which three college friends hit the road during a reunion. But why does one of the three, while they're stopped at a convenience store, emerge from the store with a young woman as a hostage? And we have a Q&A with Joseph Haywood, the author of Red Jacket, which is the first in a historical series set on Michigan's Upper Peninsula in 1913. And he says, I left some of the conversations in their original language so the reader could experience the linguistic mishmash and confusion of such a melting pot.
Well, indeed. In science and fantasy, so science fiction and fantasy, you've got a book that just as a concept strikes me as one that is very timely indeed. It's the story of Jane. But first, something new from G.T. Almasi.
Yeah, Almasi is another debut author. I guess we're top-heavy with debuts this week. This is an interesting alternate history novel. It's set in the 1980s, but these 1980s are very different from the ones we remember. In this case, the four victors of World War II were the U.S., Russia, China, and Germany. And now those four countries in the 1980s, in their own version of the Cold War, are keeping a close eye on each other with mechanically and biologically enhanced super spies. And the heroine of this is a 19-year-old second-generation spy who's assigned to retrace her father's steps on his last mission. The reviewer says there is blood dripping from every page and a breakneck pace. And as you mentioned, we have Jane, the Woman Who Loved Tarzan by Robin Maxwell. This is a very familiar story, but told with a distinctly feminist point of view. Jane is a paleoanthropology student as she meets Tarzan and he leads her around the rainforests of Gabon, Africa. She is just astonished and delighted by the diversity of plant and animal life and the cultures that she finds there. And it's definitely been updated for modern sensibilities. Jane is no shrinking violet. There's some spunky heroine cliches, but she really is happy to go tromping around the forest and chasing elephants. And also the caricatured African cannibals that some may remember from the original Tarzan books have been replaced by a more complex and sympathetic tribe of Waziri who have a hidden treasure that motivates some formidable European villains.
Well, it's fascinating, Rose, the way that Edgar Rice Burroughs just won't go away. In fact, that book was authorized by the estate.
Yeah, it's I believe it's the first Jane story and the first by a woman to be authorized by the estate. And it's always interesting to see how books like this take the original source material and work with it for modern audiences. Sometimes that's more successful and sometimes less. But hopefully this will be a better Burroughs reimagining than the John Carter movie.
I was just thinking that as well. What have you got in romance?
In romance, there's a bit of fantasy, too. A Lady and Her Magic by Tammy Faulkner is a solo debut for Faulkner, though she has written before. She's half of the team that writes as Lydia Dare. This is a paranormal Regency romance starring a disguised fairy on a secret mission to help the young daughter of a scandalous duke. And of course, Sophia the fairy and Ashley the duke fall in love. He thinks that she'll be scared off by the rumors that he killed his wife, but of course, it's her secret origins and history and her mission that really threaten their happiness. And it's an unusual story and very absorbing and buoyed by skillful writing and believable characters with good chemistry, which is always so important in romance. In religion, Michael Morris drew on family history to work some magic in his latest novel, Man in the Blue Moon. In this World War I era tale, Ella Wallace is scrambling to keep home and family together after her husband falls more in love with opium than with her, and then he vanishes. And then along comes, in a most mysterious way, her husband's cousin, who has some unusual skills as well as a secret past. And they work together against bankers and other reptiles, says the review, in the swamps of rural Florida in this affecting story of unhappy families and healing. In children's, we've got lots of good stuff. In the picture book section, there's a review of Bear Has a Story to Tell. This is the first collaboration for Aaron and Philip Stead since their Caldecott Medal winning A Sick Day for Amos McGee. We also have a review of Mo Willems' latest, his take on the story of Goldilocks with hungry dinosaurs standing in for the bears. And we have a roundup of picture books based on nursery rhymes and other songs, including some from Ireland and the French Caribbean. In the fiction department, we review Newbery medalist Patricia McLaughlin's prequel to Gertrude Chandler Warner's beloved Boxcar Children series. We also review Splendors and Glooms by another Newbery winner, Laura Amy Schlitz, as well as a grim but enchanting Selkie story from Margot Lanigan, The Brides of Roll Rock Island. And there's a roundup of guidebooks on everything from writing to babysitting to the end of the world and a page of kids' comics.
And in nonfiction for adults, l'histoire de l'amour, or at least the way the French tell it.
Yeah, How the French Invented Love. It was written by scholar Marion Yellum. We have a Q&A with her, and she talks about how her own perspective on love was influenced by women writers like Louisa May Alcott, Charlotte Bronte, and Emily Bronte. And she says they were all sentiment and no sex, which, of course, is very different from the French take on things. We also review Kurt Vonnegut's Letters, edited and with an introduction by Dan Wakefield. Our reviewer calls it a miraculous volume of selected letters that provides a moving and revelatory portrait of the famed author of Slaughterhouse-Five and Cat's Cradle. They're organized by decade from the 1940s to the 2000s, and the volume begins with a warm retrospective essay, as well as a preface for each section, giving an overview of the decade of Vonnegut's life. And there are some helpful notes to explain his references. So it's something for everybody. It's really not just for the scholars, but for the fans, and they will find it as spellbinding as his best novels. We also review Bonded Labor, Tackling the System of Slavery in South Asia by Siddhartha Kara. Kara had written the book on sex trafficking inside the business of modern slavery. And now he turns to Bonded Labor, which is a type of slavery in which the servitude commences with an agreement by credit is provided in exchange for pledged labor. So this is, you know, I'm in debt to the company store, basically. And it's a really interesting scholarly account of the practice. That doesn't hesitate to get right up close, sensitive to the nuances between regions and occupations. It's intimate and effective in individual conversations with victims, perpetrators, and defenders of this particular type of slavery. And it's usefully explicit about the actions that individuals, groups, and governments can take to end the practice. Our reviewer says it warrants profound attention. In the online annex this week, we have The Art of Luke Chua, Bearing the Unbearable. This is a striking showcase of the artist's street-styled pop art mixed with playful and acerbic surrealism. And working with a limited but vivid palette, Chua explores dark themes in an almost cartoonish manner, creating an unsettling cognitive dissonance that more often than not revolves around his signature bear. And also, we have Ariana Bundy's collection of family recipes from her native Iran, a welcome splash of color and exotic fare. It's called Pomegranates and Roses, and it includes roast quail stuffed with rose petals, onions, and pistachios, a delicate custard laced with rose water and decorated with edible gold leaf, and a hearty meal of rice, meatballs, rice, dates, and raisins. So this assemblage of Iranian classics and comfort food is one to work through and savor slowly.
Well, I'm not sure how to say bon appetit in Farsi, but I bet it's in that book. And finally, the pick of the week.
The pick of the week is The Middlesteins by Jami Ottenberg. This is a panoply of neurotic characters in a multi-generational novel about a Midwestern Jewish family. Shifting points of view tell the story of the breakup and aftermath of Edie and Richard Middlestein's nearly 40-year marriage as Edie slowly eats herself to death. Richard and his brilliant but demanding and ever larger wife raise two children who now have to contend with their parents' divorce as well as their own lives. And Attenberg makes her characters' thoughts seem utterly real, and her wry observational humor often hits sideways rather than head on. And Edie's overeating, which could just be a punchline to a terrible joke, is really described with great sensuality and will resonate with the readers the author's many fans. So this is a really messy and layered family portrait of three generations of women.
Well, I can't imagine a family portrait if it was true to life that wasn't just a bit messy. Rose Fox, who reviews for PW and blogs at Genreville, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burris Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book, and have a very happy 4th of July.